Our next bidder, excuse me, is file A241897, Larissa Wedberg, respondent versus Canvas Health, Inc. Who's the respondent? Judges Eid and Bond join me, Judge Sleater, for the second of four oral matters that we have today on our schedule. And while counsel are getting ready, I'll just make a couple of preliminary comments. We do live stream these proceedings and also record them. So for that reason, we do ask that you identify yourself for the record when you approach the podium. No other recording is allowed absent pre-approval from the judicial branch. And the audio recording of the proceeding will be on the court's website, typically within 24 hours. We do ask also that you keep an eye on the clock that's on the face of the podium. Also, there's a button on the front face if you want to adjust the podium to your comfort as well. So with those, counsel for appellant, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Pamela Spera, and I represent the appellant, Larissa Wedberg, in this case. Larissa Wedberg has brought claims for under the Whistleblowers Act and wrongful discharge in violation of public policy. The district court dismissed her complaint, finding that the statute only applied to testimony and, as the court said, that it had no application in the context of workplace communications. Today, I would like to address a couple of sections in the case law that I discussed in my brief that I think specifically, even more, maybe precisely or precisely address what the district court found.
Ms. Barra, before you get to the case law, I want to inquire about the statute. And from your briefing, it wasn't made clear to me, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to maybe make it clear to me. Would you, are you arguing the statute 595 is unambiguous? Or would you agree it's unambiguous?
So the Minnesota Supreme Court in In Re Hope said that, ruled a couple different places in the decision, the plain meaning, the court referred to the plain meaning of the statute, the court referred to the plain language of the statute.
So from that, you're both your own interpretation and from the analysis in the Hope case, you're agreeing that the 595.02 is unambiguous.
Well, yes, Your Honor. If there is, so in In Re Hope, the court said, well, we, because the parties disagree about the interpretation statute, we will address statutory interpretation.
Well, let me follow up then. So assuming that you agree it's unambiguous, and I understand your point about we don't simply look at a title to make that determination or that gives the full meaning to it. But when I look at the title of the chapter, it says witnesses. And then when you look at 595.01, a witness is a person whose declaration under oath is received as evidence for any purpose, whether such declaration is made on oral examination or by deposition or affidavit. And then, of course, we get into 59.02, which starts out with all competent witnesses can testify, and then there's exceptions. And the exception is the one we're dealing with today, an exception to the rule. So my broad question is, how, under the facts of your client, as your client pled them, where she doesn't fit the definition of witness as noted in 595.01, would that statute apply?
Well, Your Honor, so, yes, the statute, the privileges, testimony is a part of the privileges. The beginning of the statute says...
Well, isn't that, just to clarify, isn't the privilege the exception to the statute?
The
in other
privileges
words, the statute
are exception.
Affirmative talks about who can, you know, everyone who's competent may give testimony, except.
As provided below.
Right.
And
so
then,
the privilege is an exception. But my question is, in terms of the whistleblower, how is it that her employer or supervisor asking her to give information violates a statute that deals with witnesses under oath?
Well, Your Honor, there are many responses to that. There is that the privileges, there's Minnesota Supreme Court jurisprudence, privileges are unique. They hold a unique place in the law because they are substantive. The plain language of the statute, as In Re Hope held, it is that the sexual assault counselor is prohibited from disclosing the information that she obtained or opinion.
But wasn't that in the context of an in-camera process the judge would use to consider whether that witness could testify? And obviously the Supreme Court said, no, it's not. We don't even get to the in-camera review. But the whole point of that process in the criminal court setting is to determine whether that witness will testify.
Well, it was about records. So In Re Hope was about records, and could the records be provided?
But what was the point of those records?
Well, but there is no discussion that the records then will lead to testimony.
But wasn't the point of those records to have an in-camera review by the judge to determine whether the witness who created those records would testify?
Well, that certainly could happen. There is a new, so again, the statute does provide exceptions to testimony, but they are privileges, and the privileges are treated differently in the law. There's a brand new case 15 days ago by the Minnesota Supreme Court that then they're relying on, the case is State v. Martins, April 2nd of this year, and in that case, the court relies upon State v. Andring, which is from 1984, and that case doesn't have anything to do with testimony. It has to do with discovery. So if the argument is just, well, it's not testimony, so therefore we're done, what about records? So in Andring, which the court in Martins 2 weeks ago relied upon, so that there are many back to, in my reply brief, in the table of contents, it's just one Minnesota Supreme Court, really, decision after another that shows that the statute is not limited to testimony.
Counsel, can I interrupt you? Is there, in this case, was there an action or proceeding within the meaning of 595.02 subdivision 1?
Well, and that was our alternative, an argument that I made in the primary brief, in the principal brief, in the alternative, that there was an arrest warrant written for the victim client, and that arrest warrant, the county attorney and the law enforcement came to Canvas to obtain this information. So, alternatively, there was a proceeding because...
But does it matter that the disclosure is between your client and Canvas rather than, I mean, even to going along with that argument, rather than your client and directly to the police or a probation officer or someone in court? You know, it's an internal communication that's being requested.
Yes, Your Honor. And that, I believe, is addressed specifically by the Expose v. Thad Wilderson case, where the therapist, the court said, was not allowed to talk to, even though there was that threat that the client had made. So in the Thad Wilderson case, Expose versus Thad Wilderson, the court said that the therapist was not allowed to talk to law enforcement or the prosecutor before that. There's also, in State v. Expose, in that case, the court says that, and I think this refutes the idea that there's no applicability, that the statute has no applicability to workplace communications. In that case, the therapist told her supervisor, DP, so that's the same kind of thing here. She told her supervisor information. The supervisor testified and the therapist testified. The court said, well, that's fine that the supervisor testified because, and the expose court makes very clear that only in that case it's the therapist, only the therapist is bound by the privilege. And so anybody that she tells in the workplace, then the privilege just disappears because then that person, as the court held in expose, that person was allowed to testify. So whatever the privileged information was, that person's allowed to testify. In Re Hope makes very clear that this privilege is treated with such care. The court says that even in-camera review intrudes upon the privacy of the victim and harms the privilege, the vital privilege between the counselor and the victim. So,
I mean, I don't disagree with you that the language in Ray Hope is quite broad and quite strong, but In Re Hope arose in the context of a case, of a court case, and we have to interpret the language of the statute that's in front of us. So it's, I am really struggling with how to fit your argument, which is a communication in an employment setting when there is no pending court case or pending legal proceeding, how to fit your argument within the plain meaning of the statute.
Well, Your Honor, again, we did have the alternative argument that what the definitions of proceeding and that them having there being an arrest warrant for the victim.
Did your client's complaint allege there was a proceeding?
That was the complaint. I'm not sure. I would have to check that. But that is, those are the facts that she has alleged, and under the motion to dismiss answer.
Did your client make that argument in the district court?
I believe, yes, we did. We did make that argument in the district court. Yes, Your Honor. In answer to your question, Your Honor, I wanted to point out that in Ray Hope, that the case is, it's very organized, but the Minnesota Supreme Court says, because the parties disagree on the meaning of may not, we are engaging in statutory interpretation. That's the very part, it's part A of the decision. That's the beginning of the decision. They say we begin with statutory interpretation. So they're not saying, I don't think that it makes, it's reasonable that that then this case, when they say, so they say we begin with statutory interpretation and they conclude, accordingly, we hold that the sexual assault counselor privilege prohibits the disclosure. And then the court says, therefore, in this case. So I think that that is very broad, that they say statutory interpretation, and accordingly, we hold the privilege prohibits this.
Isn't it true, counsel, that the court was analyzing the rights of the defendant versus the privilege of the counselor? So
well, yes.
In that context, that's what the court was making those policy arguments that you're referring to, and in a broad way, but it was limited to that comparison in a criminal proceeding.
Well, I mean, that could be an interpretation, but I think I think it's very clear that the court says we're engaging in statutory interpretation, and this is what it means. Also, too, there are many arguments I made in my brief. This destroys the privilege in many situations, that if all that's protected, that the privilege means nothing until somebody's subpoenaed to testify. I mean, I give the analogy to the priest. You know, the priest could go to the police and reveal, I just was had somebody confess they murdered somebody, and then once the person's on trial, the priest can't testify. The damage is already done. There are many arguments I make in my brief. There are many scenarios that we can come up with where it doesn't make sense at all. In Ray Hope cites the Pennsylvania Supreme Court case, Commonwealth v. Wilson, and in that case, the court explains, it uses three words, meaningless, inconsequential, and absurd, that's what they say happens if you just give the court the records, then prohibiting the testimony, I said it backwards, but prohibiting the testimony once you gave the records is absurd, meaningless, and inconsequential. And that is what happens here. And again, in State v. Expose, the court makes very clear that DP, the therapist supervisor, well, she can testify. And so the court says the statute doesn't apply to third party testimony, that, you know, the person's in the workplace, she's not the therapist, she's not specifically addressed. The court says that the explains that it's only the person to whom the privileged information was given who is prohibited from disclosing it. But if this case has ramifications, Your Honors, beyond just the specifics of Larissa Redberg and her job as a sexual assault counselor. If the sexual assault counselor privilege means nothing doesn't apply in any context outside of testimony. There are many, many scenarios that anybody could come up with that show. By the time it gets to testimony, what's the point? And I also talk about, so the client, so the conversation with the client, the therapist, the sexual assault counselor cannot say, this is confidential. That's a huge point that the In Re Hope Court makes, the whole chilling effect, and that's what they're trying to avoid. The state has a compelling interest in the confidence, the privacy of sexual assault counselors. There's U.S. Supreme Court law I cite in my brief that without that confidence, victims are not going to feel comfortable sharing anything. So
wouldn't In Re Hope Coalition have protected if Canvas was then subpoenaed to give the information in a court proceeding after your client gave the information to Canvas, wouldn't the information have been protected from use in court at that point outside of the organization?
Your Honor, I think that, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Feel free to answer, finish.
I think it's the expose. Should I answer?
You may.
I think the expose court discusses that the person who is in the workplace obtained the information, that person's not prohibited from testifying. So, again, if the privilege is only for testimony, there are endless scenarios where it doesn't mean anything and the client would be told, as I explained, I think, in the reply brief, your information is confidential if I won't be able to testify you against you. Or I won't be, not against you, but I won't be able to reveal this information in test. I can't do that. But if my employer demands it, to give it to the police, to give it to the prosecutor, if a family member comes and my employer, then, well, sorry, that's not. That is almost the definition of a chilling effect, Your Honor.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and identify yourself and when ready, begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is James Sherman of Wessel Sherman Law Firm. I represent the respondent, Canvas Health, Inc. I would like to, I'm here to support the district court's well-reasoned decision in this case, and I believe the district court followed existing precedent, including primarily in the Kratzner case, where the court stated that in deciding whether or not conduct is protected activity under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act case, that's a Minnesota Whistleblower Act case, whether it's protected, it's not relevant whether, in this case, Ms. Redberg felt that she was following a statute. The inquiry for the court is whether or not she is alleging facts that, if believed and if found to be true, would violate a law, and in this case, the law relied on is the 595.02 sub 1 sub K statute on privilege for testimony in court. We've argued that it's not applicable. Appellant has argued, and we've pointed out, I believe the cases appellant relies on have nothing to do with Minnesota Whistleblower Act analysis, and much of that case law is called precedent that this court must follow. And we disagree. For instance, the expose case was a case involving, as the court's already acknowledged, the interaction between a defendant's rights to get a counselor's records and the statute in a criminal proceeding.
Counsel, similarly, why wouldn't it be objectively reasonable for a sexual assault counselor to rely on the holding of In Re Hope, which is, as the sentence states, it's not tied necessarily to a court proceeding. We hold that the plain meaning of 595.02 subdivision 1K prohibits sexual assault counselors from disclosing the privileged records unless the victim consents.
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. I think that is in the context of a decision addressing disclosure of those records in a criminal court proceeding. I don't think there's anything in the In Re Hope decision that suggests it should be applied outside of that context. The other cases cited by appellant are similar. The Heaney case, I think, was cited. It's a blood alcohol disclosure case that resolved the matter not on the Minnesota privilege statute, but on Wisconsin law. The Thad versus, Expose v. Thad. There's two expose decisions. They're confusing. I'm sorry. But the criminal court case was somewhat similar in that the defendant was trying to access a therapist's records. And so it was in the same context. The civil case, appellant has represented, is precedent for the fact that these disclosures apply before a proceeding. And that's just not the case. We've pointed that out in our brief, that, in fact, looking at that Thad civil case, it was a case where the criminal defendant in a civil case had accused the clinic and its employee of violating the Minnesota Health Records Act and of violating the invasion of privacy by disclosing the client's or the patient's information. That court, that decision, I've read it a few times. I don't see any reference to the 595 statute whatsoever. It decided and ruled against the defendant's clinic and its employees' defenses based on absolute privilege for testimony in court and on the duty to warn statute, which was also present in the federal court proceedings. So we maintain that the more applicable precedent for this court is based out of Katzner, Obst, other decisions that talk about Minnesota whistleblower cases and whether or not a plaintiff can prove a protected activity. I would like to just point out...
Would your point on that be that the only point by these facts in which it could hypothetically get to a whistleblower is if under some scenario Canvas required the counselor to testify or pressured her to testify in a criminal proceeding?
Yeah, yes.
Or any proceeding?
Yes, I think so. And she wasn't discharged for that. I would also note, which kind of forest for the trees, but in looking at the statute, the 595 statute, where it identifies on the sub K, where it identifies the sexual assault counselor, it has a very specific definition of that counselor. It's not just that individual undergoes a minimum of 40 hours training. It says undergoes the 40 hours of crisis training and works under the direction of a supervisor in a crisis center. And a crisis center is my client, Canvas. And so Ms. Redberg worked for my client. She wasn't a separate entity in and of herself. She was its employee. And the supervisor whose direction she worked under was the last person who met with her the day she was discharged. There are allegations about earlier meetings, other managers there. But the day she was discharged on the 15th of May, she met with her, and this is from the pleading, I think it's paragraph 54, but she met with her direct supervisor and who asked her to disclose information, explained it was to assist and facilitate the care of this individual and to allow an individual to refuse to provide any information whatsoever to their employer under this kind of a framework under the statute would leave my client absolutely unable to fulfill its obligations to this teen. It too had obligations.
What is your response to opposing counsel's argument that if the privilege doesn't apply in this situation, that it really undermines a counselor's ability to tell the client that what's going on in that therapeutic session is confidential, especially when information that's being asked to be revealed would presumably lead to criminal matters for the client?
Yeah, the record doesn't have any information about what Ms. Redberg did or didn't say to this individual. So I could only speculate about that, Your Honor. But it seems to me that the argument that effective services could not be rendered to this teen without refusing to disclose any information about those conversations to my client, which is itself a crisis, there wouldn't be a relationship with this unidentified teen had there not been an employment with my client, who is a crisis center. So,
but to take another spin on Judge Bond's question, what do you make of your colleague on the other side's argument that the privilege really doesn't exist if the information is given by Ms. Redberg to Canvas, and then Canvas basically is not barred from providing that information for use in a criminal proceeding? There's no, I mean, I think, as I understand the argument, then the privilege really is illusory because there is no legal impediment, which was the question I had asked her regarding whether In Re Hope Coalition would have barred Canvas, and she's pointing to expose and saying, no, that's not the case. Do you have a response to that?
I think there's two sides to that argument. I think if information that is disclosed to Ms. Redberg and or her employer, Canvas, is disclosed openly, there's probably some violation as the expose suit involved, invasion of privacy and so on. There are limits on that. But this particular case is a whistleblower case alleging that the 595 statute was violated, and I think it's already been said that the fact that it's disclosed to an employer doesn't open the gates to going into court and disclosing this information or disclosing it wholesale. And the flip side of that is, and I think has been argued by the appellant, is that all an employee need do is to say, I have a concern that sometime down the road, my information to an employer might be used in a court proceeding. And there is no record in this case that there was a pending court proceeding. The statute relied on and includes the anticipates that there must be a court proceeding. So I think it's somewhat, I would analogize it to the appellate court, the plaintiff and appellant in the Kratzner decision, who had a case involving brokerage disclosures of conflicts of interest and relied on a statute in a whistleblower case that required certain disclosures, that the conflict be disclosed to the parties. There was no question in that case that the conflict was disclosed to the parties, but on appeal, and the defendants prevailed then, and on appeal, the plaintiff convinced the appellate court that the spirit of that statute, going outside that statute, the spirit of it, I don't know that that exact word was used, by the way, I'm not trying to quote the case, but clearly the analysis is from the Court of Appeals, going beyond the letter, the narrow reading of that statute. And when it got to the Court of Appeals said, no, it may, you know, we see their argument, there's some sense made to it, but this is a whistleblower case. And this whistleblower case needs to be narrowly defined. The Supreme Court said that it needs to be narrowly defined. That's our controlling precedent. We've said this over and over. We don't want the Minnesota Whistleblower Act expanding to areas. The last thing I would say,
I'll ask the same question I did counsel for appellant. Do you agree with her that 595.02 is unambiguous?
Very unambiguous.
Thank you.
On its face, yes. I lost my train of thought. Well, if there are no more questions for me, I guess I'll end it there.
I see no other questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And counsel for appellant, you now will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I guess I will start with the unambiguous. So if it is ambiguous, again, in In Re Hope, it was the court said we'll engage in statutory interpretation because this party says shall not, and so that means one thing, may not means one thing. Anyway, so if it is ambiguous, then
I'm sorry, if it is ambiguous?
Yes, if it is ambiguous.
But just to clarify, it sounds like you're both agreeing that it's unambiguous.
I guess I'm not sure because the Minnesota Supreme Court in Ray Hope says the plain meaning of the statute says prohibits disclosure by the counselor. than somewhere else in the decision. It says the plain language. So that would seem to mean it's not ambiguous. But again, in that case, because the parties disagreed on a part of the statute, the court engaged in statutory interpretation. My briefs look like I think it's ambiguous because I have a whole bunch of Minnesota Supreme Court jurisprudence supporting the appellant's view of the statute.
Can I ask you that? Can you point me to a case in which the privilege was invoked in a non-hearing, trial, deposition, sworn affidavit setting?
I think that the Thad Wilderson case, the expose of the Thad Wilderson case, is the closest. In that case,
isn't that the follow-up of the criminal case? That was the same disclosure, right, that the criminal court was dealing with, and then he brought a civil action?
Yes, exactly. But that case is about the liability of the therapist and the clinic for disclosing.
Would you agree with counsel for a respondent that 59502 wasn't even identified in the?
I'm almost positive. I believe it is. It is. It's because they say that the absolute privilege, that the absolute privilege principle is directly counter to the therapist-patient privilege, and the court does, at that part of the decision, reference the 595 statute, and that's a civil case. So most of these cases are in the context of criminal cases. And I think that speaks to the highly unusual facts of this case, that the counselor would be terminated for asserting the privilege.
What's your response, though, to Mr. Sherman's argument? What I was taken away from that is that we need to narrowly look at the request from Canvas to your client and whether or not the statute that was, for purposes of the Whistleblower Act, that was a request for your client to violate the law, not what Canvas might do with the information, which it seems to me where you get into the expose type analysis, right? Because the information is given by one therapist to another person who then gives it to the police and then it's used in the criminal proceeding, right? So what's your response to the idea that we should just be narrowly looking at whether or not Canvas's request to your client was a request for your client to violate the law? Because at that point, looking at the plain language of the statute, it would be helpful to understand how that request was a violation specifically, just if we're looking at it between Canvas and your client, how that was a violation of the statute.
Well, the police actually called Ms. Redberg on that day. And so the police did call her directly. The facts, the amended complaint makes very clear in a couple different places that Canvas made very clear it was working with law enforcement and it was working with the prosecutor and that they required, so there didn't seem to be any question. But it's a violation. So if she tells them this is the part of the expose decision. As with other privileges, this is the State v. Expose, the Minnesota Supreme Court. As with other privileges, the privilege is essentially designed to forbid compulsory disclosure by the person to whom the confidence was extended. And then they conclude that DP, the supervisor of the therapist, DP's testimony was not subject to the privilege. So, again, it's was it a violation of law? The whistleblower statute is narrowly construed. There has to be an actual law, and there is an actual law, because to all of the interpretation from In Re Hope is that the sexual assault counselor privilege prohibits disclosure. And the court doesn't qualify it, but again, this is an unusual case, but it has huge ramifications because if the counselor, the court in Re Hope is so concerned about the chilling effect. The Minnesota...
counsel, your time has expired.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. We request reversal of the district court's decision respectfully.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days.
Thank you.
You have a good day.